Welcome to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm Kelly Corrigan, and today I'm wondering about these bodies that we live in and how hard it is to keep them safe and in good working order. In particular, I'm wondering about the doctor-patient relationship and how we can interact with each other in ways that help us get the right care at the right time. My conversation today is with a beloved Bay Area pediatrician named Sarah Handelsman, who just so happens to have taken care of both my daughters since the early 2000s. And my second guest is Dr. Catherine Takacs-Witkop, who is yet another model of the kind of intellectual humility we've been talking about this month on Kelly Corrigan Wonders. So join us. We'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates national average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm Kelly Corrigan, and I've been doing a bit of a study this month on something called intellectual humility, which is, put simply, knowing that all knowledge is partial, meaning we don't entirely know our children or our spouse. We do not have and will not have and never have had complete information that could factor into a work decision. Not if you're the CEO, not if you're the summer intern. Doctors, which is what we're talking about today, are rarely considered humble. In fact, there's a common and well-known God complex hanging over the profession, even though the Hippocratic Oath is so unambitious. First, do no harm. The doctors I have with me today are lifetime learners who love collaboration and feedback and ongoing education. They're naturally curious, they respect the patient's point of view, and they challenge their own assumptions and snap judgments. First up is a conversation with pediatrician Dr. Sarah Handelsman. I'm so happy today because one of my most special people, one of the people I feel luckiest to have ever met, is on the pod. This is Sarah Handelsman, and Sarah is the pediatrician for both of my daughters. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Kel.
So a thing about intellectual humility, which is really what we're here to talk about, is intellectual humility in medicine, is that you have to be upendable. You have to listen with a willingness to be affected by what you hear and let what you hear change your course a little bit. And so I thought it would be only proper to begin the episode by telling people how we met. So I was a 6-month pregnant woman in Berkeley, California, on the internet looking for doctors. And my husband, Edward, is an Ivy League weenie wad, and he noted that there was a woman who was a pediatrician not a mile from our home who had gone to Harvard. So instantly, you became our first choice. And I marched on down, and I met you, and you were really nice and asked lots of questions. And I said, I definitely want you to be my kid's doctor. And you said yes.
Yep.
And then I also said, before I left the room, by the way, this might seem kind of weird and sudden, but I have a friend who is single, and you are so his type, it's like crazy. It's like hitting me over the head with frying pans. And if you'd ever want to go on a date with him, I'd love to set you up. And you said what? You said not really, not yet.
Not yet. Although I don't think that was the first time we met. I think we became friends in the course of you bringing Georgia to see me. I think it was maybe when she was around 1. That's my recollection.
Oh my God, you're crazy. I remember coming, you're crazy, I'm sorry. That's not a very intellectually humble thing to say. But I just can tell you that I came home from meeting with you and I said to Edward, oh, she's totally great. Yeah, she's definitely going to be the kid's doctor. But also, I think she's going to marry Handy, which is our friend, Mike Handelsman. And he was like, what are you talking about? And I said, I'm telling you, like, I just met Handy's wife. She's like his dream. Like, when I tell him that this person exists, that there's this adorable, short, Jewish pediatrician who went to Harvard, and I can bring her to his door, he will never stop saying thank you. And guess what happened? Exactly that.
Yep. We owe you our marriage.
Well, you used to call me on your anniversary sometimes after you'd had a glass or two of champagne and say, I just want to say thank you.
Right. Although we joke that we actually thank Georgia.
Yeah.
Not you.
Yeah. That's
good.
Just
steal your thunder.
I don't need that much more attention.
Right.
So this is a series about intellectual humility, and we wanted to talk about this very common experience that all people have of going to doctors. And it seems to me that there are two things working against intellectual humility in the doctor-patient relationship. One is time, and two is this deep desire on the part of every patient for clarity and certainty and a nice, tight diagnosis and a treatment plan and probably a prescription. So can you talk about how the pressure to see some number of patients in the course of an hour or a day works against your ability to enter every appointment with a modicum of humility, and also how much pressure you feel at this point in your career coming at you from patients or their parents for something fast, sure, and actionable?
Ironically, the longer that I have been in practice, and it's been over 20 years, actually, the more comfortable I am now saying, I don't know the answer, than I was when I was, like, you know, 1 or 2 years out of residency. I think it made me more uncomfortable to say I don't know, and I was quicker to give a pat answer or sort of tell the patient what I thought they wanted to hear. And I'm just much more comfortable saying I don't know.
Now, as you're older and you're more confident in your skills and your relationships and your standing in the community,
yeah,
it frees you up, which is really interesting because in an earlier conversation in this series on intellectual humility, Daryl Van Tongeren, who is this academic who studies intellectual humility, said that security and humility are linked. And it goes to that larger idea that confident people who are comfortable in their area of expertise are more likely to say, I'm going to have to learn some more before I give you a firm answer there.
Right. And I think that the other thing that I have learned over the years is that there are going to be a lot of times I don't know the answer. And one of the things that I say probably most often in my office is, I know the things this is not. Okay, I know this is not an infection. I know this is not something dangerous. I know this is not something that's going to last forever. But I don't necessarily know what it is. But there's actually good value in saying the things that it is not.
Yes, of course.
And that it's okay to say, maybe we're going to find out what this is. Maybe we're not. But as long as I know it's not one of these really bad, dangerous things, or something that we need to act on right away, then we kind of have to be okay not necessarily knowing for sure what it is. One of the things that I don't remember if I learned it in med school or in residency is we talk about Occam's razor, which people have heard about, and that the simplest explanation is the most likely one. So, you know, if a patient comes in with a fever and a limp and a rash and a headache, well, probably there's one disease entity that is explaining all of those. But then, and this sort of goes to this sort of intellectual humility, is there's the corollary is Hickam's dictum, which is the patient can have as many diseases as they damn well pleases. And it's sort of a jokey thing, but I actually think of it a lot because our brains are wired to try to find some simple explanation. But there are going to be times where the kid comes in and you know what? They have three things and those go with one diagnosis and they have another thing and it has nothing to do with it. And if you're sort of trying to force everything to fit in, you sometimes lose the big picture of, yeah, there might be a couple things going on and I need to remember to like push myself to not go for easy answers.
Yeah. I mean, the temptation to categorize on site.
Right.
And it's not a MASH unit. It's not mm-hmm. like over here with the right. stuffy noses and over there with the headaches. And,
right.
you know, like it has to be this one-to-one thing. Yeah. So yeah, that's a really good note. Why did you want to be a pediatrician?
So I had some medical conditions when I was a kid and I had a couple of really great doctors who were interested in me as a person, who I could tell cared about me, and they were nice, interesting people to talk to. Like, I had great connections. And the two main doctors who I think of, one of them was still a practicing pediatrician when I started in practice, and I would see him at the hospital when I was making rounds, seeing newborns, and he would be seeing newborns there as he had seen me in at that same hospital. So I thought that was pretty great. And the other one is a specialist who I still refer to, who it's been, I think, for both him and myself, a real special thing that after he took care of me for a long time when I was a kid, we're now colleagues. And he has over the years called and specifically asked if I'll take a patient who he's caring for, and I've called him about patients. So I was really fortunate to have a couple of really great doctors when I was a kid.
And you wanted to be one, and you are.
Yeah.
In my experience, as someone who has been coming to you with the most important thing in my life for all these years, something that you've given me that I so value is parental education, which is to say, here's one for you, parents everywhere. 40% of the time, you're never going to find out what exactly happened. Why right. they threw up, why they had diarrhea, why they were crying for a week, why they couldn't get out of bed for a month. Like, most questions don't have great, satisfying right. answers. And I imagine yeah. you're teaching everybody who's coming to you with their big yeah. eyes and their precious, precious cargo saying, help me make this kid better. Just teaching us, your kid will get better.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not actually going to have like a whole bunch of detail about what just went down.
Right. And that's obviously a lot easier when it's something sort of lower stakes, when it's a rash that's not really serious. I mean, pediatricians see rashes, you know, every day, all day. And sometimes it's really obvious what caused it, but most of the time we don't know. We say, maybe it was that, maybe it was that. But it doesn't really matter. We think it's going to go away. The situations that are a lot harder for patients and honestly a lot harder for me are these chronic headaches, chronic stomach aches, things that are really disruptive to a kid's life. But that the odds are we're not going to be able to find some really clear-cut explanation. And maybe 20 years from now, we'll know a lot more about what causes chronic headaches and chronic stomach aches. But it's sort of limited right now. And we do a lot of, okay, this is what it's not. We've done all of these lab tests. We've checked all of these things. We've tried these treatments. It wasn't any of those. But I don't know what it is. And that's a much harder situation for families, understandably, and for me too, to not really be able to give them any real clarity.
Yes, but don't you think that at some level, when parents bring a kid in with some kind of chronic pain, that like the level one come down that we're looking for is, it's not a tumor, they're not having a heart attack, we can eliminate these super terrifying 3 a.m. visions that you're having. I mean, at some level, another thing that you taught me early in my parenting was, if you're lucky, it's a lifetime of near misses. That is a direct quote from you. And I have thought it, and Edward and I have said it to one another, and I've mm-hmm. shared it in front of 150 audiences. Like, don't forget this, that it is,
right.
if your kids are climbing trees and running races and swimming in lakes and living with parasites and pandemics and going to school and having their heart broken, you are going to have a lot of bumps.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's it unfolding as it should.
Right.
Other than just seeing more patients and more diseases and conditions and accumulating that kind of experience, how do you get better at being a doctor? And what recently have you had any big growth spurts in terms of understanding a new kind of thing that can wreak havoc in a kid's life?
The pandemic was transformative to anybody practicing medicine. And it's been a continual learning process of how much it has changed medicine that I feel like it has made all of us humble as doctors, because there was so much that we could not anticipate. So in this really short time, we went through these huge swings that I just could never have imagined before COVID hit. And I think going forward, I probably will approach new things that come along with more kind of curiosity and humility of, yeah, I can't anticipate what that's going to be. Things are not always predictable and the same.
Yeah, maybe we all just got humbled, right? Because there's so many false alarms and the media is so good at sniffing them out and splashing them all over every paper. I mean, it sort of reminds me of the people who are in hurricane zones where they say, leave your house. And they're like, oh my God, if I left my house every time people told me to leave my house, I'd never be in my house. And it's like, yeah, and then it happened.
Right.
And so now I think, like, I remember a couple months ago, I saw a headline about monkeypox. And I just talked out loud back to the headline and said, no, no.
Yeah.
You take your monkeypox and you put it somewhere because we cannot handle that right now.
Exactly. And there had been other things before. Like, I remember when Zika was first in the news, and we now sort of had in our mind, okay, we're going to ask people their travel history recently if they come in with a fever. But then it just didn't really amount to much in kind of the demographic that I was serving. And I think initially we kind of assumed that COVID was going to be the same. And in one night, our practice figured out like how to do telehealth. That would be something that before we would have studied for 3 months and tried out different platforms and whatever, and it forced us to adapt in a very quick way that we just could never have imagined.
Coming up next, Sarah and I talk about the intellectual humility reflected when we use the word we rather than the word you. We'll be right back with Kelly Corrigan Wonders. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are just right for the role you've got. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. It has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. LinkedIn gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else, all the while making the process easy and intuitive. I mean, when you have that many quality candidates, hiring gets a lot easier. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. So maybe you're 24 hours from finding your perfect next hire. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/Kelly. That's linkedin.com/Kelly to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. The 10% Happier podcast has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? Hosted by Dan Harris, a journalist who had a panic attack on national television and then set out on a journey of transformation. He's now on a quest to help others also achieve peace and happiness. Every week, Dan talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity in wide-ranging conversations that explore topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. The interviews cover everyone from Brené Brown to Alexander Draymond to Sam Harris. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. Find 10% Happier wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm Kelly Corrigan, and I'm talking with beloved pediatrician and close friend, Dr. Sarah Handelsman. Is there a question that you've learned to ask that's kind of been like a go-to for you in terms of helping you understand what's going on with a kid?
I think one of the key things is, and this seems kind of trite, you would expect hopefully every pediatrician to think this way, is that the parent really knows their kid the best. And so if that parent is saying, this isn't like him, and trying to find out, okay, what is it about that that you know something is wrong? It still may be this is some, you know, temporary, not very serious thing, but I think asking from the parent's perspective, what is so different for you that you see in your kid that, you know, even if I know my patients pretty well, I'm not going to notice those subtle differences. Mm-hmm. One of the most fascinating and luckily really rewarding cases that I had recently was this adorable, awesome four-year-old patient of mine who developed a really serious and scary neurologic condition. And I hadn't, in regular practice, after residency, taken care of a patient with this. And it was really hard to know what to anticipate of how this was going to play out. And I was talking to the parents constantly. He was in the ICU at the hospital. And part of what I knew that this kid was this hilarious, super bright kid who was so funny. I loved seeing him in the office. He'd always crack me up. And I remember making a point to the doctors in the hospital, because he was not in good shape, of helping them understand this is what his baseline is like. This kid is a real firecracker. He's super smart, and really verbal. And just so they had a sense of sort of this is his, you know, normal. And the parents and I talked a lot of like, okay, we're just going to get through one day. We don't know what tomorrow is going to be. We just have to get through one day. And then we'll see the next day. Okay, how did we get through today? And luckily, he made a great recovery and was back to cracking up and telling me jokes. And it was a huge relief. But my knowing sort of his normal and his parents being able to say, this is just not like him, was really helpful.
Yeah. The other thing I was hearing is that you said, we, mm-hmm. we're going to get through today and then we're going to get through tomorrow. Like, there's just yeah. no better word than we when you're mm-hmm. in a crisis.
Yeah.
And like the worst yeah. word is you. Well, you just need yeah. to get through today and you just need to get to tomorrow. Like, that's it's just putting you all alone over there on your stupid island.
Right.
And we is like heaven.
Right. And I think that is something also that with years of being in practice, I remember when I started in practice being terrified of calling patients. Like, oh my God, why are they going to wonder why I'm calling them? And now it's sort of the easiest thing I can do. I can follow up. I can be like, I didn't know what was going on when you were here. I've been thinking about this. I looked this up. I talked to this other person. And I'm very comfortable with that now. And I feel like it makes it so much easier for me to do my job that I'm able to do that.
Take a beat, look things up, talk to colleagues, yeah. like bring in more yeah. information.
For sure.
Right. Instead of pretending like you're this old-fashioned doctor who's got it all under one roof.
Well, and I think, like, to its credit, I think the medical establishment has realized it's no longer that there's this sort of like monolithic, like, this is medicine and there's some good doctor there that can know it all. It's not feasible. There's too much information. It's constantly changing. And so I'm frequently going to references and looking things up and have no problem telling patients that I'm doing that. And when we do our, you know, accreditation exams now, you're doing it, answering questions where you can look up the answers because that reflects what practice is now. It would be ultimate hubris to think I can know everything on my own in my head all at once. It's not possible anymore.
Well, that reminds me of Atul Gawande's checklist manifesto. mm-hmm. which is just an utterly humble move, which is to say, before we start surgery, we're just going to go down this list. We're just going to mm-hmm. make sure we know which boob we're operating on. Like, I remember having a lumpectomy, and the last thing that happened before they put me under is that someone came in and said, which breast? And then they took out a Sharpie, and they wrote on my skin so that it was, like, unmistakable. Right. And this checklist manifesto had all kinds of simple, simple things on it that, on a good day, nobody in that room would make those mistakes. But it's not always a good day. And people have lives. And then you have your own children and your own husband and your own parents and your own set of concerns that have nothing to do with that room and that patient. And so we should be able to say to one another, hey, let's put this checklist on the wall. Let's make sure that this patient needs a leg operation and not an arm operation.
Right. And the corollary to that is that I also, with having been in practice a longer time, I feel comfortable like apologizing to patients if I missed something or forgot to do something or didn't know in the moment what I should be doing about things. And I think it doesn't help anything if you're sort of avoiding, like, a parent is mad at you that, you know, you missed the pneumonia and the doctor the next day found it or whatever it is. You know, we're operating under the sort of best intentions, but you can't be perfect. And hopefully there are systems in place to avoid mistakes that are really
catastrophic.
You know, catastrophic. But on the margins, there are going to be little things that, you know, get missed. And I think you have a better relationship with the families if you can acknowledge those. And say, you know, I'm sorry, I messed that one up.
Yeah. Do you have an intellectual humility role model in all your professors and colleagues and maybe people who you worked with during your residency? Is there someone you admire for their ability to stay in that beginner's mind and stay curious and keep growing?
Well, one of the things that is great about my practice, you know, we have a group practice, I'm sure, over the years. You saw a handful of the other ones when you weren't just calling me at home.
All right, so I called you at home a couple times. Whatever. You don't have to out me to everybody.
is that we all, I remember being on your doorstep with Claire looking at her rash.
Yeah.
We all use each other as second opinions all the time. And until one of our senior doctors recently retired, but he was, you know, beloved and revered in the community. And he probably asked the most questions as far as second opinions of the rest of the doctors in the group than anybody else. So I think my colleagues, we have the model for, you know, it's okay. I did this the other day with one of our newer doctors, younger doctors, of, I don't really know what to do with this patient. You know, he has this rash, he has this fever. I don't know. Should I put him on antibiotics? I'm not really sure. And, you know, brought the other doctor in. He also was like, yeah, I see why you don't know. And we kind of went back and forth, and you sort of have a hierarchy of issues that you look at. And, okay, I think if it is this and we don't treat it, that's a bigger problem than maybe him having an unnecessary antibiotic. So, okay, we're going to go ahead and treat him. But I think that is one of the great things about the practice that I'm in, is that we all feel very comfortable having each other help us to figure out things that are tough.
Well, I love that the oldest and the most experienced was the first to ask the questions.
Yeah,
like, what a great, what a great bar to set for the rest of you. It's like, this is a place where it's worth asking for second opinions. I mean, just the idea of getting a second opinion is an intellectually humble position.
For sure.
How does intellectual humility play out for you as a parent? Like, because you know whatever you know from your practice and from treating all these other families, what comes home with you? What would surprise people about your parenting as someone who's a doctor?
Well, I think if you asked my kids, they would probably say that anytime they bring up any symptom, my only response is, you're fine. which I think very much frustrates them. You know, I have had some issues over the years, actually, with both girls that were a little bit of kind of medical mysteries and were frustrating. And there was a lot of check these things off the box, they're not those, and then just have to be okay with not knowing. And then luckily with time, things got better. I think, you know, if my kid has an ear infection, I'm going to look in my kid's ear and say they need an antibiotic. That's a nice side benefit. But for some of these things, I did say, okay, I'm the parent right now. I can't be the doctor. And they have a different pediatrician in my practice. And I would say, okay, I need you to take it out of the equation that I'm a doctor here. And I need you to figure out, do we need to worry about this? Is this something that we need to do?
Mm-hmm. So you hand them over. You defer to another
doctor.
I do
hand them over. Absolutely. Yeah. But still, the majority of the time when my kids complain about things, I probably do say, you're fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one takeaway is that we're going to have to be comfortable hearing the words, we'll have to wait and see.
Absolutely.
Let's keep an eye on it.
I think that's one of the things over practice that I have learned the most, that time is our friend, and that sometimes we just need to let things play out.
Well, before we go, I just want to say, I think you're the most incredible doctor. I think you're one of the people I know who I feel completely indebted to you. And you're so well-suited for this job that you have that I'm almost glad you were sick as a little kid, because otherwise there are a lot of people who are counting on you, and you're really good at it. So thanks.
Thanks, Kel.
Before we move on to the second conversation in this episode, I thought that I would give you some insight into where I'm coming from as a patient. We have, all of us, been in doctor's offices many times as parents, as adult children of people needing care, and often as the patient ourselves. And I thought it might be worth sharing a short reading from The Middle Place that describes an interaction with a doctor after I had finished a lot of treatment for breast cancer in my 30s. An interaction that was surprising and disappointing and probably quite common. Over the past couple years, I had planned for 4 children. In our crawl space are 2 giant leaf bags full of maternity clothes that I felt justified spending real money on. I invested in the best breast pump, since the cost would be amortized over 1,000 hours of breastfeeding. I picked an environmentally insensitive car because it has 3 rows of seats for all the kids. So as my doctor starts talking about hormone therapy now that chemo and surgery are complete and my periods have begun again, I am missing the disconnect between hormone therapy and 4x40. My mantra. It's been 20 years since biology drifted over my head, so it's not obvious to me that estrogen is produced by the ovaries, and never once did I equate the oft-referenced hormone therapy with induced menopause. When the genetic testing came back and Susie Eder handed me the report saying no gene mutation found, I took that to mean that my fertility was not at risk. When Susie and I were hugging about keeping my ovaries, well, I mean, what's so great about keeping my ovaries if I can't use them? I interrupt the doctor, making my husband Edward uncomfortable. Wait a minute, are you saying I'm not going to have any more kids? Well, we need to eliminate estrogen from your system, the doctor says, looking at Edward in a way that says, you know what I'm saying, right? So, yes, I mean, no more kids, at least for the next 5 years. He says, but I'll be 42 in 5 years, I say, like he should be ashamed of himself for leading me on. And then he says the thing that everyone says, the thing that pisses me off every time, not only because it's Pollyanna, but also because there is no response to it that doesn't make you look like that greedy brat Veruca Salt, who wasn't satisfied even in Willy Wonka's bountiful factory. You do have 2 beautiful girls, he said, recalling our first appointment when I showed him the pictures of Georgia and Claire on my keychain. Now, would you say you do have 9 beautiful fingers to a man who just lost his thumb? Unless you have 8 fingers, I say you should keep your glass half full crap to yourself. Edward is relieved. To him, suppressing ovarian function is another way to keep me safe, another couple percentage points in my favor. What does he know? He has one sister, a handful of cousins. He doesn't know how noise becomes music. He doesn't know that five or six people can be moving in and out of the kitchen, doing dishes, wrapping leftovers, picking at the pie pan, and you can feel someone squeeze your shoulders and not even need to see who it is because any one of them is welcome to give you a little encouraging rub, and any one of them would. He doesn't know what it feels like to be at a lacrosse game in Baltimore and move from one row to the next, plugging into the family current, cousin after aunt after uncle after cousin, all conduits for the charge, all contributing to the magnetic field until you can practically see it. For the first time since I was diagnosed, I am seething. You can imagine, having gone through what I've gone through, that I am particularly sensitive to and impressed by intellectually humble doctors. My next guest is Dr. Catherine Takacs-Whitcup. Kathy is a professor of OBGYN and preventive medicine at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, and has such a wise and informed take on the patient-doctor relationship and what she calls shared decision-making. So, Kathy, you're a doctor with a lot of degrees and experience in multiple contexts, but you're also, like so many people listening to this, taking care of people, like parents and kids. So I wanted to start by understanding how to be a better patient, how to be a better partner with the medical professionals in our lives. So my guess is that tons of people come to you and say, I looked at my symptoms on WebMD or Cleveland Clinic, and now I know this is what I have. Don't you think I'm right? Does that happen every day?
It happens frequently, yes. What I would say is absolutely the best way to be an advocate for yourself or for a loved one, the best thing to do is to go in prepared. And so we absolutely value when patients do what we call pre-work and look up these things. The important thing for both the patients and the, I'll speak about physicians, but any health professional, any medical professional, is to recognize that Dr. Google may have some flaws and there may be some errors in what they find online. Even reputable websites may not directly apply to your particular condition, your particular situation. So I think doing that pre-work is helpful, and I think it's important to do that for both yourself and for anyone you're helping advocate for. I think as health professionals, we also need to recognize how important that pre-work is for that patient to come in feeling empowered and being able to speak to what they're experiencing and to ask them questions about what they've learned and to really encourage that agency that patients come in with often or their loved ones who are trying to advocate for them. But at the same time, on both sides, I think it's important for the patients to realize and to have that humility about the information that they're bringing in may not be accurate, and the physician to have that humility to understand that the patient's coming in with a lot of knowledge about their own personal experiences that they can't possibly understand. And to meet in the middle and to both recognize the importance of debt pre-work, but then have a discussion about it and really get to the bottom of what the patient is feeling and what they're coming in with.
Yeah.
My area of study, what I'm really interested in, is something called shared decision making. And that was the focus of my research, my medical education research, when I just finished my PhD. And the concept of shared decision making is that the patient's values and preferences, their perspectives, are as important as the knowledge and the medical evidence that the physician brings to the table in making a decision about how to move forward with a particular situation. And these are preference-sensitive decisions. So these are not decisions about whether someone needs emergency surgery, but rather things like surgery versus medical treatment for low back pain, or different kinds of chemotherapy versus radiation therapy for cancer.
Prophylactic mastectomies.
Yes, exactly. So preventive surgeries or immunizations, which immunizations to get, when to begin mammography screening for breast cancer is another area where between the ages of 40 and 50, we recommend this shared decision making. Shared decision making, in my mind, is really this concept of patient-centered care, where really patients' perspectives and their values and their preferences around the decision to be made are as important as what the physician brings to the table.
It's encouraging for me to hear that physicians don't really mind a little pre-work and that it can be useful, but it also does bring to mind all the things like confirmation bias. If there's some huge long list, if I have a set of symptoms and I'm trying to figure out if I have the flu, and then I look at the big long list and the three that I have are almost exploding in front of my eyes like a billboard, and the nine I don't have are like getting whisked away like a car in the rearview mirror, then when I come to you and say, I'm sure I have the flu, I went on WebMD and I have all the symptoms, then you say, do you have this? Do you have this? Do you have this? And then I say, I don't have that, but I do have this. And it helps us all be more honest about the way that the machinery works and how it's affecting our sort of hit rate on diagnoses and potential medications.
Absolutely. And I think that the recognition on both parts is that this can happen, that this confirmation bias can occur. I think the patient does bring so much to the conversation, though, beyond that list of symptoms. And I think that's where that clinical interaction is really important. And it's important for the patient to share not just a checkbox of those symptoms, because, yeah, they may not fit, but there may be other symptoms that the patient's experiencing and other things going on in their lives that could be impacting whatever medical condition is that they may have. And I think sometimes these online checkboxes, if you will, or these list of symptoms are almost, they almost tend to then limit the conversation with the physician, because then the patient may not be thinking about some of the other things going on in their lives that could actually really help the physician or help the medical professional figure out what's going on.
Asking great questions and being hyper-observant and some of the soft skills that go into being a great doctor. With kids, it's so clear that you're only getting a partial story because they're kids. But we should assume that even adults are only giving us a partial story.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, we talk in medicine a lot about something called social determinants of health, which I think it's even, the definition's, I think, a little limiting. But basically, it's important for us to look into the other aspects of the patient's life that almost certainly are playing into whatever chief complaint they are coming in with. And it's important for us to dig into that story and to listen to that story. We teach our first-year medical students in medical interviewing, we teach them to ask open-ended questions to begin with. And you'll appreciate this. One of the phrases that we encourage our students to use when they're interviewing patients is, tell me more. And that alone, those three words, in the context of that medical interview, will hopefully elicit that rich tapestry of that patient's life that will bring so much more to the table in terms of the physician being able to understand the context that the patient's living in. And that context includes not only the physical symptoms that the patient's having, but the context includes where they live, who they live with, who their support network is, their culture, their upbringing. I mean, that may not come out in the beginning of the conversation, but if it does, that just really adds to the ability for that physician to be that private investigator, if you will, and to figure out what's going on with the patient, because there's often more to the care of that patient than just diagnosis. An astute clinician can potentially make a diagnosis, but what we've realized is these other aspects of their community, their family situation, their work situation, stresses that they're feeling, their faith, all these things can be impacting their health negatively or positively. And understanding that as the physician is really key to being able to care for that patient in a holistic way.
We're in a series about intellectual humility, and that's a funny term that I don't think is widely used. But I wonder, when we introduced this idea to you a couple weeks ago about having you on, if it resonated, if you thought, yes, I have thought about this a lot as a doctor.
Absolutely. One of the things I mentioned earlier, learning about the context of the patient, one of the things that we teach our students and that I'm constantly thinking about is this concept of cultural humility. It's almost a subset of intellectual humility. It's the recognition that we don't necessarily understand everything. that's impacting the patient's health and well-being, and that those things are as important as their physical symptoms and the physical findings and kind of what your diagnosis is. So that's one aspect of what I would call intellectual humility. The patient brings a lot of knowledge about their lived experiences and what they've been going through and all the things that we talked about earlier related to their environment and their social context. But secondarily, we talk about knowledge, skills, and attitudes in our learners, so in our medical students. What are those knowledge, skills, and attitudes that they need to possess in order to be a doctor? And we spend a lot of time during medical training increasing our knowledge base and learning skills and practicing skills. But one of the skills that is, I think, the most important to learn, hopefully early on in medical training, is being able to reflect and self-identify gaps in your own knowledge, setting goals, again, even as physicians, about what they want to learn, knowing the resources that they need to fill those gaps, and then evaluating whether or not you've accomplished those goals. And this skill of self-directed learning is teachable, and we do teach it to our students, but it's the attitude, that desire for lifelong learning, that we really hope to instill in our students. And I do think the majority of physicians do internalize this idea of lifelong learning because medical knowledge is just evolving so quickly, which is wonderful in so many ways. But to keep up with that is just so important. But that recognition that there's no way as human beings we can keep up with everything all the time, but rather being able to identify those gaps in our knowledge, potentially when a patient walks into your door, right? And presents with symptoms or conditions or something that you've not seen before, and to ask lots of questions, and then that ability to say, I don't know right now.
Yeah.
But together, we will figure this out.
Yeah. It's like growth mindset versus fixed mindset. If you feel like you got everything you needed in medical school, it was really long, it was really hard, I took a million courses, I stayed up till 4 a.m. studying, I did these residencies, I'm done. I've got it all. And now I'm going to apply it for the next 40 years versus the information is changing and improving and there are contradictions, there Absolutely. Are multiple theories, there is not one way of treating many things, and I should stay loose. I should stay in a learner mindset. I should stay in a growth mindset. It also points to collaboration. Because if there are gaps in your knowledge, one way to fill them is to go back and get another degree or take a class or stretch in some other way. But another is to collaborate. Like when I had breast cancer, everything I did went to the tumor board. So they took my films and they put them up on a box and six people sat around and they looked at my 7 cm by 4 cm constellation of tumors and they talked about it. And they took a stab at how to handle it. Should I do chemo first? Should I do chemo every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks? Should I start with Adriamycin? And just being in a culture where people are expected to lean on each other and to help fill in each other's gaps is a certain kind of mindset.
Yes.
I guess in some ways, this is a time for dispassionate curiosity. Like, it'll never lead you wrong just to ask more questions and... But it's so funny to hear you say, and others in this series have underlined this too, that it's the super skill is asking questions, listening, and then acting on what you've heard. And so not just nodding through things, but actually letting it change your opinion and change the next steps. And asking questions and listening are, I feel, two of the least common skills on planet Earth. I think most people do not really know how to ask a great question, much less a follow-up question, much less a follow-up question, which is the only way to get to the thing behind the thing. I think most people would rather talk than listen. And I think most people nod through commentary, but they don't actually let it bump them off their position. They don't actually change their mind. They just tolerate the incoming sounds until it's their turn to talk.
Yes, I know you've interviewed Brian Stevenson before,
yeah.
And he actually spoke at a medical conference in 2019 that I attended, and I'd never heard him speak before. This was before I'd read Just Mercy and had seen the film, and it was the first time I'd ever heard him speak, and I was just blown away by not only what he had to say, but how applicable it is to us as medical professionals, to us as parents. There are a few concepts he talked about that really resonated, and probably the one that really stuck with me that's applicable here to your question is the importance of getting proximate. Those are the words he used. And in his world, that meant going to the prisons to speak with his clients in their setting, or going to their families' homes and understanding and listening and speaking with the families. As medical professionals, unfortunately, most medical professionals don't have the opportunity to go to do house calls like they used to, go into people's homes to see their surroundings. Now, we do encourage that, and actually something that, you know, even in medical training, we have our students go for at least one home visit, but we don't unfortunately get to do that very often. However, at the very least, I think that being proximate in a clinical setting means putting the computer aside, putting your paperwork aside, maybe even moving around your desk and sitting there face to face with your patient, looking them in the eye and asking the questions, but then listening intently to the answer, to every word of the answer.
Thank you so much, Kathy. It's awesome to talk to you.
Thank you so much. This has been fun.
Here are my takeaways from my conversations with Sarah and Kathy. Number one, security and humility are linked. Confident people who are comfortable in their area of expertise are more likely to say, "I don't know, I'll have to learn more before I give you an answer." Number two, quite often the simplest explanation is the best explanation. Number three, for parents everywhere, if you're lucky, it is a lifetime of near misses. Number four, when you're in a crisis, there is no better word to hear than we. Number five, you know that you're in an intellectually humble culture when the oldest and most experienced person in the room asks the most questions. Number six, a patient's values and preferences and perspectives are just as important in making a decision as the knowledge and medical evidence that the physician brings to the table. Number seven, three simple words from a doctor, or really anyone, can make a big difference. Tell me more. I'd like to thank Sarah Handelsman and Kathy Witkop. I'd also like to thank the team at Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That's technical producer Dean Kateri, executive producer Tammy Stedman, and all of you for listening. Join us on Friday for another For the Good of the Order, and on Sunday for a new Thanks for Being Here. Until then, I'll see you on Instagram at Kelly Corrigan. Funding for this episode was provided by UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center as part of this initiative they have to expand the awareness of the science of intellectual humility, work that is supported by our friends at the John Templeton Foundation.